This is lecture 39. We are dealing with hardcore interactions. We discussed the quantum mechanical example last time, in which the potential was basically 1 over x to the power alpha. And we learned that if we plot lambda on a horizontal axis, lambda being the coupling constant, and theory schematically on the vertical axis, where theory stands for example for the collection of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions, there is a point F, standing for free, on the lambda equals zero axis. And as we increase lambda, there's a branch here, which we could mark alpha less than or equal to 2, that was continuously connected to the free theory. We found a way to introduce a regularization, a renormalization proportional to the delta function, and a power series expansion in terms of coupling constant and divergence term. We also saw what happened when alpha was greater than 2, that there was a theory for lambda equal to 0, which we call PF, or pseudo-free. This is the case when alpha is bigger than 2, and we are in this branch. As we saw, if alpha was bigger than 2, we let the coupling constant go to 0. We returned to a point here, which was not the free theory because we had subtracted a certain term from the traditional term. So take a moment, look at this kind of graph. Suppose you start with the free theory, and you turn on one of these singular perturbations. You turn it on for arbitrarily small lambda, you instantly jump to this branch of the curve, move out here depending on what your particular alpha is, and as the coupling constant is reduced, you go by continuity back to the point PF. So that interaction is a discontinuous perturbation of the free theory, but it actually is a continuous perturbation of the pseudo-free theory. And indeed, if I turn it on again, back and forth, it would be as continuously connected to the pseudo-free as is the less singular cases, alpha less than or equal to 2, continuously connected to the free theory. I want to carry this over to a quantum field theory today. And we'll start with our standard example. So I put in my external source with an I just for convenience. My interaction will make it a Euclidean theory. So let's see, I put my bracket there, 1/2 there, and a brace there. M squared phi squared plus my lambda. Well, let's do it this way, dmx. And then I have my phi to the fourth dnx over here. Dnx is well with that, and I integrate d phi. This is the expression with a suitable normalization, which we'll call S of lambda of H.
Although there's no lambda in it.
Yeah, there's no lambda.
No lambda. Let's put a lambda in front of our interaction term. Thank you. That's to be compared with our free theory, which has a similar appearance, except that the coupling constant lambda is zero from the start. And we ask ourselves, under what conditions is it true that the limit of S of lambda of H as lambda goes to zero, under what conditions is it true that that will actually give me the free theory? That seems so evident. But I hope I've begun to shake your faith in this business a slight bit. This would be a continuous perturbation. A discontinuous perturbation, on the other hand, would have the feature that the limit as lambda went to 0 plus of S lambda of H was not equal to S0 of H, the true free theory, but instead was equal to a pseudo-free theory, S0 prime of H. We saw that in our pictorial representation, where W0 stayed inside of V. Over here, W0 and V intersected in a non-inclusive way. Now, I'm going to give you an inequality here, which will point to the situation. The inequality reads as follows. The integral of phi to the fourth of x dnx, I would like to bound by some combination of the free expression dnx. This equation is incomplete at the present time. Suppose I put 37 or something over here as a number. I can always violate that number by simply increasing phi large enough. On the right-hand side, the quantity scales proportional to the magnitude of phi, like phi squared. On the left-hand side, it scales like phi to the fourth. So I can always beat that. Let me get rid of that situation by putting a power 1/2 here. And that makes both sides scale like phi squared. I'm going to tell you that there is a constant here which holds under certain circumstances. That constant, C, can be 4/3. In the situation that you deal with a two-dimensional, a three-dimensional, and a four-dimensional theory. On the other hand, that's why it's in this column, C is infinity. That is to say, there is no such bound when n is greater than or equal to 5. N equals greater than or equal to 5 was what we call non-renormalizable previously, according to the basis of perturbation theory. On this side, this is what we call renormalizable. The implication here, if we carry this to the extremes, would say that the n equals 2, 3, and 4 situation, the renormalizable situation, corresponds to a continuous perturbation. And as such, there is a fighting chance that you might make a perturbation series with regard to those terms. The non-renormalizable situation over here, which holds for n greater than or equal to 5, there is no finite C. Let me give you an example of what that means. If there's no finite C, if C equals infinity, that means there are fields for which this integral on the right-hand side, the free term, is finite. But for the same fields, the interaction term on the left-hand side is infinite. If this term is finite and this one is infinite, the only way I can satisfy this less than or equal is have an infinite multiplier. Analogous to the picture I have just sketched is the idea that there is a free theory for quantum field theory. And what is connected to the free theory are the renormalizable theories. while the non-renormalizable theories are those connected to a pseudo-free theory. Stated another way again, start with a free theory, turn on however weakly you want a non-renormalizable perturbation, you instantly jump to this branch of the curve. You move out here as lambda gets bigger, and by continuity, you will come back to this term. We saw that in the guise of a projection operator, chi, which had the effect of projecting out those fields for which the potential term was infinite while the free term was finite. And that left us then with the formal definition of the pseudo-free theory.
I have a question.
There is a question.
The formula you wrote about the 5 to the 4th?
Here?
Yes, I'm puzzled by the way the brackets are. Are they outside?
Sure, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. 1/2 is absolutely outside of the whole integral. Thank you so much. Well, you might ask whether this is a special property of the phi to the fourth theory that it fits this way. Let's go to an interaction term which I will call phi to the power p in n dimensions. And we'll let p be an even integer so that things are familiar. This would then correspond to an interaction which is phi to the power p dnx, and I would like to bound that by a constant of a similar kind, gradient phi quantity squared plus m squared phi squared dnx. This has the same problem we had before in that this scales at a different power of phi, so let me remove that correctly to begin with and raise that to the 2 by p power. Now the left hand side scales like phi squared, just like the right hand side. Such theories can also include non-renormalizable theories and renormalizable theories. The renormalizable theories, we haven't discussed those in great detail at all, or discussed them at all in this set of lectures. But those fit in the category where p is less than 2n over n minus 2. Let's just check this in the case we know. N is the space-time dimension. So let's go to four dimensions. So that's 8 upstairs divided by 4 minus 2 is 2. 8 divided by 2 is 4. So that says if the power p is less than or equal to 4, we are in the renormalizable situation. And that's exactly what we have here. The non-renormalizable case, according to similar kinds of arguments we sketched for the phi to the fourth situation, corresponds when p is greater than 2n n minus 2. That would be p, this number for four dimensions would be 4 again, so p would have to be bigger than that. That would be a larger power, or if we insist that this be a 4, then we can go to 5 dimensions. That's 10 divided by 3. 10 divided by 3 is 3 point something or other, which is a number smaller than 4. So I'm saying this conforms with our knowledge about what happens for the fourth power interaction, but it extends it according to perturbation theory. This is the perturbation theory results. Does this picture conform with these results for perturbation theory? And the answer is yes. C is finite, in fact, 4/3. is a nice universal bound for any p and any n for whenever p is less than 2n over n minus 2, and c is infinity. In the opposite case, when p is greater than 2n over n minus 2. So here again, c is infinity for all of the known non-renormalizable theories. C is finite for all of the known renormalizable theories. When C is finite, it means that the free action controls the interaction action. Question?
It looks like this works for odd p's also, so why do you restrict to even p's?
It does work for odd p's. If I put in an absolute value here, then it works for non-integral p's as well. However, from the point of view of perturbation theory, we simply don't know what to do for non-integral p's. And even a p cubed is not really a great theory because it has a potential of a no ground state. Question?
The c is universal for all values of m?
Yes. Yes. The c is universal for all values of m. There is a dependence here. I forget exactly what it is, but C depends on P and N, but I've given you a number which is the upper bound for all of those possibilities.
What is your S naught for a discontinuous perturbation? How would you define S naught?
S naught prime?
No, S naught.
S naught is the free theory. S naught is Gaussian. The question is, what is S naught prime? I would love to know S naught prime. For the quantum mechanical case, that was really quite straightforward because all we had to do was to eliminate all those pairs that want to cross the point of singularity. That's much more difficult in this situation. If I'm in the non-renormalizable situation, which means I have a finite field here, a finite integral here, and a diverging integral on this side, that can be arranged by having a field phi of x, which is, if you like, is smooth. Well, I don't care what it is here, actually. Plus a small amount, let's call it epsilon, of a singular field of the kind, here let's take care of infinity, that's not important, 1 over x to a certain power p, well, better make it r because we've used up p, and if I remember and I won't have this correctly, well, we can do it in our head here, we want, let's do the fourth power situation, we want 4r to be greater than n, so the fourth power of this thing is divergent. But I want the derivative of that, which will be r plus 1, squared to be less than n. That makes the gradient term finite. So I find out what the r power here is. So we have 2 r plus 1 less than n, less than or equal to 4r. And if n is 5, let us say, and we have 4r, 2r plus 1. So what do we learn? That r is greater or equal to 4/5. From this side, we have 2r is less than 3, so r is less than 3/2. That's right or not right? That looks right.
Yeah. So one works.
One works. So there's a whole range of R here which will cause me trouble. Okay. But that means that near every field, if the board is a field, near every point here where the smooth term is, there is arbitrarily close in the norm of this a point here which is singular. That's not the same as this situation, which we had for the quantum mechanics situation, where I can talk about paths which are far from the singular paths.
That path is very far from the singular path in any measure that you would like to put down, like the kinetic energy. That's not the case over here. So it's a transcendental concept. Question?
Not that it matters, but that should be 5/4, I believe.
Here, 5/4? You're absolutely right. 5/4. So this is 1.5 and this is 1.25. And so we make it. We have a little window. Thank you for the correction. Smaller window, but it's a window nevertheless. Okay.
So this is far more pathological than a hard core ordinary core.
Yes.
Because you can always get away in a metric from a hard core, but you can't.
You cannot ever leave this the hard core.
It's a hard carpet.
Okay. This you got the basic message. This is a time to then move on to chapter 8, our last chapter, the subject of the rest of this lecture and next Wednesday, which will be our final lecture. We're going to talk about a soluble model.
It has a name. It's the independent value model. And you'll soon see soon enough why it has that name.
Okay.
This is the problem I would like to solve right here. This is the one for which theses are given. There was a time when Julian Schwinger was the reigning professor at Harvard Physics Department. He attracted an enormous number of students. He assigned every one of them the same problem. Solve 5^4 in 4 dimensions was his game. None of them succeeded, of course. Still an open problem. They all found something interesting else along the way. Got their thesis, but you know, it's a very easy way to not have to think about a hard problem to get, you know, just the right amount of problem to get to a student. Okay, I can't solve this either. But I would like to solve for you another model. We'll call it, we're going to call it S again. I write it down. It's going to look similar. Differ from the one above it in a profound way. It's missing this term, missing the gradient.
Before you start, can you make your definition for soluble and insoluble more rigorous?
Sure. That will be the subject of the next,
this lecture and the next.
You'll see. I will evaluate this integral for you. Okay? Up to one constant. And you remember strongly my leading premise from the first days of this course, never evaluate an integral. Okay, I have removed the gradient squared. There's no physical reason, no justification to do that. And I'm not saying this model has physics. It is an exercise in functional integration. Can we solve this model? If we learn how this one works, and I will illustrate for you that it has exactly this kind of behavior of a hard core, then maybe it will teach us something about this one. And indeed, people have taken this solution and have tried to introduce this expression by a perturbation series. That's not our goal. We're going to look at this second model, and we're going to eliminate this other one. And the goal is to try to find it. Now, I'm going to make a pledge. If you all take the pledge, we're going to keep an open mind about about the meaning. Of our integral as lambda of h. Oh, I want to see everybody's hand, right hand up in the air.
Yes.
I swear to abide by this pledge.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We don't know what missing terms are there. There is an h bar. We're allowing an h bar, which we're not writing. There is an h bar here. There may be corrections to this. We don't understand what we should interpret this as. We certainly don't understand what we mean by the fourth power of a singular field. This problem is of the kind we're talking about because m squared phi squared integral cannot bound with a constant phi to the fourth dnx to the power 1/2. That would be the analog statement of the thing I have erased here. A function which is square integrable is, for no reason, going to be fourth power integral. We'll have singular points here, which I raise it to a higher power, will diverge. So we are in that situation. Okay, so there are renormalizations, etc., that will take place. I insist, or assume, and I hope you go along with me, that the symmetry that this problem has is preserved by those renormalizations. What is that symmetry? The symmetry is that every point x lying in our configuration space here labels an independent field variable. The field variables were not independent before because of the gradient. That meant they coupled together, but there's no gradient now. So what happens at point x and at point y, different points, are totally independent of each other. That means the answer has to be of the following form, L h of x dnx. That is the characteristic form of a characteristic functional, this is what this is, with independent values at each point x. Before we go further, let's think about the free theory. Free theory, the lambda equals zero.
John, lambda, L in this is implicitly lambda dependent, right?
Sure. Here is our free problem. I will assume it is Gaussian. The answer then with normalization is e to the minus 1 over 2m squared integral h of x squared dnx. That means it's of the form 1 over 2m squared h of x h of y times delta function of x minus y, n dimension, I won't write that down, dnx dny. So the analog of capital G of x and y, which we spent some time finding its asymptotic dependence, is now replaced simply by direct delta function. Perturbation theory. And by the way, this answer is exactly of this form too. That's an exponential, which is of that kind. Perturbation theory, when I would expand this out in a power series, I would get curves, and let's look at this one. That's a graph we talked about previously. That would have x1, x2, that would have g of x1 minus x2 quantity squared here. But that would be delta of x1 minus x2 squared for our new form. Therefore, our objects are diverging like delta of 0, which I will call 1 over epsilon to the power n, that is a cutoff, that is its dependence. This graph, which has six legs, involves delta of x1 minus x2, delta of x2 minus x3, delta of x3 minus x1. Integrate two of those, and I get another delta of zero again. So this one is also 1 over epsilon to the n. That already means I need a 5 to the 6th counter term for this theory. Likewise, if I have 8 legs, again, same divergence, I need a 5 to the 8th, etc. So this is perturbatively a non-renormalizable theory. Let's look at it from the point of view of lattice theory. Lattice formulation. So I go to a lattice, and I take e to the I summation hk phi k, replacing my integral by a Riemann sum, I will call delta, the lattice volume, a to the n. I have a m0 squared of a, summation phi k squared delta, and then I would have a lambda 0 of a, summation phi k to the 4th times delta, integrate over all points of the lattice, normalize it properly, and this would become my, well, let me put the delta up that way. Delta CH of delta, like that. And the quantity of interest will be as the limit, in the limit, delta goes to zero. But these are independent, identically distributed random variables. Think back in the course. Central limit theory. This is the power, I'm going to expand this thing out, h, 1 minus hk squared over 2, summation phi k squared times delta squared, minus or plus hk to the 4th over 4 factorial, the odd terms disappear, phi k 4th. Delta to the power of 4, da, 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 raised to the nth power, more precisely, product over k. Well, we've drawn pictures like this before. We have a distribution that's narrow. This thing has to be like 1 over delta, square root of delta, so that the square of that can be like a 1 over delta, so I can get a single delta here. If that's the case, that's the magnitude of that, then the fourth power of that would be like 1 over delta squared. But put that in as a 1 over delta squared, that gives me a delta squared net. Too much, well, too little is too small. And so this will limit to e to the minus summation 1 half hk squared, this is uniform, times some constant, capital A, times delta, or limit becomes an integral, e to the minus 1 half h squared of x dn x times that constant, Gaussian domination, central limit theorem. We pause a moment and remember what is the story for the 5 to the 4th theory in n dimensions where n is greater than or equal to 5. That's the relativistic theory, the one we would really love to have. The properties were that this was perturbatively non-renormalizable, just like this example, but also when we put it on the lattice and took the lattice limit, we got a Gaussian answer, just like this example. So my toy example, without the gradients, has the two major diseases identical as the relativistic theory. I claim, therefore, that by studying this example, we might learn something more about it.
Okay. Let's go back to our analysis of this guy. Our S lambda of H is of this kind. Moreover, the Fourier transform of something positive, I will insist that that be the integral phi dnx of some countably additive measure. Well, the next will follow a pattern. I won't go at the same. It's going to be numerically valued p for x in a small cell delta, and going to be 0 for x outside of a small cell delta. But choose a particular choice of h. So that means S lambda of h becomes C lambda, I'm not going to worry about the lambda so much anymore, of h with a subscript delta, which is e to the minus delta times L of p. The numerical value of h inside this region is constant, it's equal to p, but the volume of that integral is delta. This is a true characteristic function. Therefore, that is equal to some integral e to the ipu d measure, let's call it rho, of u depending on delta. I can find what L is by taking 1 minus e to the minus delta L of p, dividing by delta, and taking the limit. Delta goes to 0. Therefore, that is limit, delta going to 0, of integral 1 minus e to the I pu 1 over delta d rho delta of u. This problem has symmetry. I have a phi squared and a phi to the fourth. So all odd moments vanish. Therefore, plus h and minus h are the same. So I have a situation where L of minus h, or minus p in this particular case, is going to be the same. So all that's important here is the cosine. Just to make life easy for ourselves, what is the functional form of that limit? We've seen this before. That has two terms, a p squared with a constant coefficient b, where b is greater than or equal to 0, plus an integral of the form 1 minus cosine pu times d sigma of u, where d sigma of u was only constrained by the condition that integral of u squared over 1 plus u squared is finite, because that's how it behaves at small u. It behaves like a the first term, the pv squared, coincides exactly with our free solution. I don't want to talk anymore about the free solution. Let's drop that. So we're going to say b equals 0. D sigma of u, however, I will let b absolutely continuous. So I will tell you that there is a function c of u squared, which is here. And the condition on c squared then is the same as this before, c squared of u du integrated u squared with the coefficient u squared 1 plus u squared should be finite. But
integral c squared du could be either infinite or less than infinite. And we will find and favor the infinite story. And the only way that can happen, of course, is c has a singularity at u equals 0, which is canceled by this term, but not canceled otherwise. Okay. So we have come to the following story. E to the I integral h phi minus a half m zero squared. I'm going to now introduce a zero there because we don't know what it really is. Minus lambda zero, we don't know what that really is. Phi to the fourth dnx d phi is of the form e to the minus integral dnx 1 minus cosine h of x u d, no, c squared of u du. And of course this c will depend on the m and the lambda properties up here. And it's our goal is to find that dependence. The only way I know next to proceed is to realize the field. This is some random, here we talked probability before. Probability means a random function. So there is some random field, phi, whose expectation value has this functional form. Let's find it. I give you the answer. Phi of x can be realized as a sum of the following kinds of things. X of n are independent, identically distributed random variables. Y sub n are random variables which are independent of the x's, and they are Poisson distributed. We've seen expressions somewhat like this before. We talked about them when we were dealing with Gaussian quantities, that for Gaussian, at that time we talked about x of t, summation xn times suitable coefficient un of t. That's what our story was then. And we talked about shot noise. Shot noise, n of t, maybe s of t, I forget which one it was. Summation xn delta function of t minus yn. This actually is the image of electrons in a circuit. Suddenly an electron makes a jump in an atom. And that jump puts out an impulse of electrical signal. And the random magnitude of that thing, whether it's large or small, for example, is determined by the x signal. Okay, that's a mathematical description. This is the analog of shot noise. Instead of having a one-dimensional delta there, we deal with an n-dimensional delta. What I want to prove to you next is that this postulate for our realization of the field coincides, gives me this for this expectation value. We do that as follows. Again, this is drawing on things you have seen, but long ago. E to the I integral h phi dnx average will be a limit as n goes to infinity of e to the I summation xn from n equals 1 to capital N of I integrate this function against h, well, that will simply evaluate it at the points yn. Distribution itself depending on how many variables there are. Okay, that is equal to e to the I integral, e to the I u, that will be its realization, and rho of u will be its distribution, h of y will have a value dny, and will be uniformly distributed in a volume V, finite. And then we take this quantity, raise it to the power n, take the limit, n tend to infinity. How do we do that? So we add and subtract. There's 1 minus 1 over V. 1 minus, I use the fact that rho has a even distribution. So that's going to be a cosine of h of y times u d rho of u dy n all to the nth power. Now I take a limit in which n goes to infinity, v goes to infinity, the volume, but the quotient, n over v, k, stays finite. That's the density of the number of these particles. In that limit, I get e to the minus k integral, 1 minus cosine h of y u dny d rho of u. Finally, I say another limit. I will let k and rho have their own little sequence, call it L. Take the limit L to infinity. This was a normalized measure. I'm now multiplying it by a constant which could increase. And I will tell you that that goes to my d sigma mu, or my c squared of u. In that limit, L to infinity, I get e to the minus dny integral 1 minus cosine of h of y u c squared of u d, which is exactly the form I have almost erased here, showing that I have indeed found a realization for my field. Okay, we are 1 minute away from closing time. Let me ask you if any questions on this. We'll meet together one more time and conclude this problem. In the course, any questions on what we've done so far? We have traded our unknown problem for an unknown function, C of u. But c squared of u is a positive quantity. We know that certain integral of it has to be finite. We're hoping another integral will show. We'll prove another integral is infinite. And otherwise, our answer is of this particular form.
So we just assume that sequence was bounded.
So the sequence in question, this one?
Yeah, we just assume that it's bounded.
Well, I don't know if it's bounded. I don't want it to be bounded. This is distributional, if you like. But if the c squared of u du was of the form 1 over u du, let's talk about, okay, like that, then this thing here could have been normalized like 1 over u plus 1 over L, that would make it finite, e to the minus u squared. The normalization of this will become infinite as L goes to 0, so I have to put in something which is like a 1 over L to reduce that. Then the case of L comes along and cancels that. That's the way that would go away and look like that. Okay, see you on Wednesday for our final celebration.